You are listening to the Doug Hagman Radio Show, weekdays 9 to 10 a.m. Eastern Time. And now the man behind the mic, a private investigator with over 30 years under his belt, Doug Hagman.
Good morning, everyone. It's 6 a.m. on the west coast of America, 9 a.m. here in the east. Welcome to Hagman. It's the Doug Hagman Investigative Hour for today. It's Tuesday, November 20th, 2018. Just 2 days before Thanksgiving 2018. My goodness, I remember 40 years ago, 1978 Thanksgiving. Now, that was the year my mom died, a month before. But I remember that like it was yesterday. So time is speeding up, isn't it? It seems that way. Anyway, I want to thank you for joining me this morning for an in-depth look at what tomorrow's headlines will be. I'm going to be delving deep into a number of important issues. First, I want to say that there are two topics that I'm covering, or that I'm looking carefully at. I'm investigating heavily the bigger story on the California wildfires. Look, it's horrific. I mean, absolutely horrific. But there's something wrong with those. And we all know that instinctively. There's something not right. The heat. And I understand. I did in a previous life go to fire training school, back in the mid-70s. I worked as a first responder, as you know, before we were known as first responders, in the fire rescue, EMT, paramedic, EMT instructor trainer. But back to the fires. Odd patterns, don't you think? Interesting coincidences I don't believe in coincidences, but interesting burn patterns. So I'm looking into that. I want to talk to some brighter minds than mine and find out what they've got to say about these. And then there's another issue that I'm looking at. And I don't know how many people caught this or know about this. President Donald Trump's drug pricing czar, a gentleman by the name of Daniel Best, he was the senior advisor to Alex Azar, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, for drug pricing reform. Dead. Daniel Best was found unresponsive near the garage door exit of an apartment building in Navy Yard, a neighborhood about a mile south of D.C. He was found just right before 5:30 in the morning on November 1st. On November 15th, he was found dead, and the cause of death, multiple blunt force injuries. Again, Daniel Best, senior advisor to Alex Azar, Secretary of Health and Human Services for drug pricing reform, President Trump's drug pricing czar. Daniel Best was found dead November 1st, 5:25 a.m., outside of an apartment building in Navy Yard. It's about a mile south of D.C. Multiple blunt force injuries. Well, on November 15th, 2 weeks after his death, the D.C. Office of the Chief Medical Examiner declared the death a suicide, saying that Best succumbed to multiple blunt force injuries without adding any further details. Now, Best was a drug industry insider. He worked for more than a decade in various executive roles for Pfizer, Universal American, Member Health, and CVS Caremark Corporation. He was appointed in March to HSS. And there was a lot of criticism surrounding his appointment from some opponents of President Donald Trump, who accused the administration of cozying up to the drug industry. Now, when you look at it, and this from Cleveland, or this from, I'm not even sure where this is from. My apologies. But Daniel Best, according to this one article, his experience could swing the other way too. as our best will know where the bodies are buried. And that's a quote from a health insurance lobbyist back in May. Seriously. A health insurance lobbyist back in May of 2018 said that Azar and Best will know where the bodies are buried. This, of course, a reference to the inside shenanigans that's going on in deep or in big pharma. Best apparently wanted to shake things up quite a bit. Now, it was 2 days before he died, 2 days before his death. HHS published a question and answer article where Best explained that one of the initiatives he led was expected to save the government more than $50 billion in its first 8 years on Medicaid and Medicare expenses at the expense of drug makers and or other developed countries. Best said this, or I'm paraphrasing from Best, Americans often pay much higher prices than people in other developed countries for some expensive drugs. Man, look, I know this to be true. My one prescription medication that I take, 30 days, $572, I believe. Anyway, the plan was to attempt to level the playing field by tying how much Medicare pays for some drugs to a selection of international prices instead of the average U.S. price. In other words, expanding the pricing pool. And many European countries, for example, exercise broad control over healthcare and dictate how much companies can charge for drugs. Conservative pundits have long complained over the oversized chunk of pharmaceutical research paid by Americans through higher drug prices. So, anyway, I'm looking into this. How a man found at 5:30 in the morning. Now, that by itself is not really an issue. I mean, these people be Best and, I mean, like myself. I mean, somebody could find me at 4 o'clock in the morning outside of my studio. It's not, you know, it's the hours one keeps. So that's not the issue. What is the issue? You're on the ground. You're dead from multiple blunt force injuries. And it's ruled a suicide. How does that work? Now, some have speculated, well, he could have jumped out of one of the apartment windows and, you know, the blunt force injuries on the way down. No. That's not how the autopsies, death certificates are written up. So this is an odd case. I'll be looking at this. Daniel Best ruled a suicide by the D.C. medical examiner. Multiple blunt force trauma injuries. And rather than get into it right now, I just want to let you know. I'm looking at this. And I apologize for the pregnant pauses there. I'm looking into this. This is something that I believe I excel in terms of looking at suspicious deaths. I mean, I did this for a number of years, multiple blunt force injuries, not consistent, certainly, with suicide. So Daniel Best, put that name, just remember that name, put that aside. I'll be looking at this more in depth and reporting on this fully in the days ahead. So the two things, just to recap here, the two things I'm looking very intensely at, the California wildfires, suspicions of irregularities there. And I know fires are, I'll just leave it at that. Before I get into the speculative realm, I want to contact some people with some very extensive knowledge on how these wildfires work. I mean, wildfires are different, for example, than a structure fire. They behave differently. But nonetheless, fires behave predictably in terms of, I mean, when you go to fire school, for example, fire training school, there is a pattern of how fires behave. So there are some issues here where cars are burnt, trees aren't, the fires following a specific pattern. But I want to say this as well. President Trump was absolutely and is absolutely correct in terms of clearing the underbrush, the dead wood, and the issues surrounding the environmental policies that added to the heartache here. He was 100% correct, is 100% correct, but that does not take away the suspicions about the irregular, the odd nature of things that happened in the fire. Okay, what I'd like to do in this episode is to give you information, ammunition that you could use at the Thanksgiving dinner table, perhaps, or perhaps afterwards, with your obtuse uncle or nephew or brother-in-law, my goodness, you know, who is a supporter of maybe Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton, or who thinks Donald Trump is just a bad guy. And I've heard this before, he's the Antichrist. I mean, my goodness. People peddling that nonsense. But some ammunition. And I want to do so in the larger sense here. Because we're, a couple of weeks from, outside of, beyond the midterm elections of 2018. And both sides, the right and the left, have spun it the way they want to spun it, the way they want to spin it. And by the way, let me just say this. I apologize for my speech patterns. I've got to tell you something. I had an extraction a couple of months ago of an upper molar that was just giving me fits for a long time. And subsequently, it perforated my, there was a sinus, a perforation into my sinus cavity. And, oh man, you know, I'll tell you what, you talk about painful and you talk about troubling. So I finally had, I had gone to the dentist that did the extraction, and he said, yeah, you got a problem there. And anyway, through some conservative treatments, didn't work. So I've got to see an oral surgeon. But in the meantime, it is difficult to talk, which makes it difficult, which makes my position very difficult, obviously. So I've been putting off, and this is on me, I've been putting off the oral surgery needed to fix this. So I apologize if I sound nasally, or if I sound, or if I slur at different times, because I'm trying to baby that side. And if you've ever tried to do that, you know how it is. So please accept my apologies for that. Anyway, it'll be taken care of here shortly. But what this episode is all about, I want to draw everything together. I try to do this just about every episode. But I want everyone to start looking at really the nature of the battle. And I've named names. And when I say, for example, in my opening, that going to be looking at tomorrow's headlines today as I delve deep into a number of important issues. Well, just today, for example, it came from conservative HQ, the website conservativehq.com, the truth about the invasion force heading toward our southern border. Well, it's there, or at least right now we've got 3,000 caravan invaders at our southern border, all right, with another several thousand on their way. I'm sorry, 6,000 at the southern border. In total, there was a number that was tossed out yesterday, 3,000 and 6,000. And I've seen numbers, just incredibly inaccurate numbers. And we're not just talking about the Tijuana area, but we're also talking about all across the southern border. But you've got an additional 8 to 18,000 coming toward the U.S. southern border. And as I mentioned in previous shows, the San Ysidro border crossing was shut down for a period of time yesterday. And I said that was going to happen. And also you've got the military just completing the installation of miles of new razor wire to discourage the wall climbing. And that seems to be working, contrary to what you see in the press. So there's that. And by the way, I don't know whether you caught, if you did catch this, Sean Hannity last night had Thomas Holman on. He's the former director of ICE, And let me tell you, I sat down with Thomas Homan in Washington on September 5th to interview him. Great interview. And I'll just say this. The guy does not mess around. He doesn't mince words. He reminds me of, and I say this with affection, he reminds me of a bulldog. I mean, this guy, you look at him, no nonsense, director of ICE, kind of guy that we need. He's a former director of ICE. Now, again, I met him and interviewed him on September 5th of 2018. It was kind of intimidating to me, frankly, because he sat there, looked at me and said, all right, what's your questions? So I said, okay, here they are. And he was very nice and very genuine, answered all of my questions. But let's take a look at this. Again, giving you ammunition for that obtuse brother-in-law or whatever at Thanksgiving. What's really going on in the United States, and should we be concerned? And I say, yes, we need to be very concerned, even in spite of the losses, for example. Some big losses. Gillum, for example, losing. Abrams, Gillum in Florida losing. Abrams in Georgia losing. As well as others across the United States. We had wins, but they were very fine, very thin wins, if I might say so myself. Too close for comfort. Now, what does this have to do with anything? Well, again, get past the spin, both on the right and on the left, of the midterm elections. I watched Hannity and I recorded and watched it last night. And yes, the Democrats picked up 37 House seats, but relative to previous midterms, for example, the 2010, Obama lost 63 House seats. We lost 37. Obama lost 6 Senate seats. We picked up, 3? Okay. 1994, that midterm, Clinton lost 52 House seats and 8 Senate seats. So relative to those two midterms, was this a win for the Republicans or for the conservatives? Well, it wasn't necessarily the loss that we experienced back in 2010, or I'm sorry, the loss that Obama experienced back in 2010, or the loss that Clinton experienced back in 1994. So it's being spun on the right that, it wasn't that bad. In fact, it was a victory. And President Trump is saying the same thing. And I would expect him to say that, not expect the cheerleaders on the right to say that. But is it intellectually true? That's my question. Well, because the left, they're claiming victory, although they're hacked off that Gillum lost, and they're hacked off about Abrams, and they're just generally hacked off about a lot of things. We seem to be missing the larger picture here. And this is what I really want to tie things together. Because I think if we look at the trajectory of the nation, that's what we need to be talking about. That's what we need to be focused upon which we need to be focused. I'm sorry. We need to be looking at that. And let me just give you kind of an overview here. Because what we're looking at is this. There is right now, and there has been for a number of centuries, this ongoing practical or physical and spiritual war between the liberty of the individual and the central control of society by a group of elitists who believe that they can best determine the optimum course for the life of each person, whether they're in America or you're listening to this in the UK or wherever you might be listening to this. It's the same group of people internationally. And by the way, this is the same group of people involved in the coup against Donald Trump, or at least they share common staff. I don't know. There's overlap. But the fight is and always been between those who believe in individual liberty and government that is the least coercive, the least nanny state, and those who hold out that the government can replace God, can create a perfect system, and can manage or be managed by elitists. where all of our needs can be determined and met. This is what the Ocasio-Cortez mentality is. This is what Bernie Sanders has been all about. When you look at this, this encapsulates, at least in my view, where we're at. I printed last night. My wife was at the studio for a little bit, and I printed 115 pages of notes for today. So if you want, grab a notebook, grab a pen. I'm going to be naming names. I'm going to be naming organizations, giving you some ammunition about what is really taking place. I mentioned, as I said before, I should probably complete the thought, shouldn't I? Conservative HQ published the truth about the invasion force and basically identified the same groups of people, the same groups, I should say, that are managing or are behind this caravan. For example, Pueblo Sin Fronteras, People Without Borders, Chicago-based nonprofit, the group that has organized multiple migrant caravans aimed at the U.S. border. Nonprofit notably organized a caravan of Central American migrants in April, known as Migrants Way of the Cross. Now, again, I'm not going to repeat the previous program I did on these groups, and you can find it. I'm not sure what episode number it was, but I identified the people, the groups, the institutions behind these organized invasions. But taking a step backward here, should we be concerned about the state of affairs in America and all across the West? Absolutely. Because what we have, as I mentioned, is this system, this battle that's between those who believe in individual liberty and a small government, and those who hold the fact that the government can replace God, can create a perfect system, and can be managed by appointed elitists. The Bernie Sanders, and to a lesser extent, the Ocasio-Cortez people, or Gillum, or Abrams, they're cut from the same cloth. We have a problem, and we must address this problem now. Because there are arrogant elitists who proclaim that they can provide for humanity through a centrally planned system that relies primarily on collectivism. You've heard me use that word, collectivism. It's communism. It's the desire for this communist utopia. And regardless of what I might call a system or what the system might be called, it relies on taking from the productive and giving it all to the rest. Again, think Ocasio-Cortez. What's her popularity? It's just that. Her lack of knowledge, her lack of intellectual prowess about the three branches of government, that be damned. No. She is popular, certainly because she is young. Some say she's attractive, but she's dumb as a box of rocks when it comes to history. All right. And when it comes to civics. But let's look at the bigger picture here and then fold in the names, the individuals who really did, who won the election, and what damage they intend to inflict on all of us, which will be the construct of the headlines of tomorrow. But collectivists, that word, well, whether fascist or communist or religiously motivated, they've got no faith in the individual or one's ability to provide for one's own needs. In fact, they don't believe that we can govern ourselves. I mean, take the Second Amendment, for example, the right to bear arms. They don't believe that we should have that right. They need to manage through a nanny state collectivist society, outlaw our ability to have guns. Why? Well, for two reasons. For our own good, they'll tell us, but more importantly, so we can't rise up and take them out for violating the Constitution. But these collectivists view people as best suited to be part of a centrally planned system created and managed by themselves, by those people. And most often, those who reject their collectivist systems, they're marked for extermination. Seriously. Go back to what was said during the Weather Underground days. Larry Grathwall, who I interviewed, we've interviewed many times on the Hagman Report, infiltrated the Weather Underground. It's that mentality. And when Grathwall said that Bill Ayers and his associates outright stated that they would have to eliminate, and by eliminate, if they couldn't re-educate the people who did not agree with the system would have to be eliminated. Think about that. That's what we're facing today. But the people who are seeking this centralized power, they often do so by proclaiming some utopian scheme that claim they will perfect mankind and eliminate competition, greed, poverty, war, you name it. They've got all the answers. And their politically driven utopian tyrants, they achieve their goals by killing off vocal opponents and by terrorizing the remaining populace into submission. Anyway, but let's get into this a minute. Let's look at the results of the midterms. Let's look at the people who were victorious, and let's look at how close some of these races were. No, not to the point of boredom. No, I'm not going to go there. I just want to give you a taste and some information about people who were voted in and tell you why they were voted in and tell you what they are going to do or what they intend to do if they remain unfettered. All right. I can take these one at a time. In fact, you can write these names down. You remember them. One of the newest members, let's see, how should I do this? All these papers here that again, my wife is like, you know, do you do this every morning? My goodness. 115 pages of notes. Well, you know, let's start with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the Neiman Marxist. Did you get that? See what I did there? Neiman Marxist, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Now, she's a perfect example of what I'm talking about here. She was born in New York City, in the Bronx, as a matter of fact, 1989. She was raised by a mother from Puerto Rico and a father who had graduated from the Pratt Institute. And her father was a founder of Kirschenbaum Ocasio Roman Architects, Cora, K-O-R-A. By no means was this family poor. Ocasio-Cortez was not poor, contrary to popular belief. And because of her father's role in establishing this architectural firm, Cora operated as a certified minority business enterprise, a designation that came with an assortment of very special privileges, most notably, special preferences in being awarded lucrative government contracts. Think about that for a second. This is the environment in which Ocasio-Cortez grew up. Back in 1991, Ocasio-Cortez, well, she was raised in Yorktown Heights, a very affluent area of Westchester County, New York, and I've been there, believe me. I mean, this is where the Clintons make their home. Anyway, now, her father died from cancer in September of 2008, and after that, Ocasio-Cortez went on to earn degrees in both economics and international relations at Boston University. During her time as a student there, she also worked for Senator Ted Kennedy on matters involving immigration and foreign affairs. Now, this is who Ocasio-Cortez is. It's important to understand who she is. Again, remember Cora, K-O-R-A. That's her dad's company. or her dad was a partner in this architectural firm. And because of his role in establishing the firm, he got all the special or many of the special preference contracts from the federal government because of his minority status. So she went to Boston University. She worked for Kennedy, Ted Kennedy, on matters involving immigration and foreign affairs. And after graduating from college in 2011, Cortez returned to her hometown, where she worked as a bartender, you know that, right? And waitress to supplement her mother's income as a house cleaner and bus driver. Now, she started a publishing company, Brook Avenue Press, which produced children's books portraying the Bronx in a positive light. And she also began to establish herself as, guess what? A community organizer. Does that sound like anyone we know? Yeah. Back in 2016, her participation in protests against proposals to situate a portion of the Dakota Access oil pipeline within the confines of North Dakota's Standing Rock Sioux Reservation. So she was already establishing herself as a community organizer back in 2016. And recognizing her potential for eventually blossoming into this influential potential figure that she now is, the newly formed leftist organization, Brand New Congress, contacted her and encouraged her to run for a seat in the U.S. House of Representatives. You ever wonder how she got where she's at? That same year, by the way, Cortez served as an organizer for who? Bernie Sanders. In December of 2017, Ocasio-Cortez spoke at a Black Lives Matter rally. You see the overlap here? In early 2018, this year, she launched her campaign for a U.S. House seat representing New York's 14th Congressional District. And against all odds, she ran in the Democratic primary against Joe Crowley, 56-year-old incumbent, 19-year congressional veteran. This guy never faced a primary challenger. Well, hadn't faced one in the last decade and a half, 14, 15 years. Joe Crowley was the fourth highest-ranking Democrat leader in the House, and he was considered a favorite to be named as House Speaker in 2018. But he lost in the primary. Okay, so Ocasio-Cortez, she is a proud member of the Democratic Socialists of America. There was an interview in Vogue magazine, June 25th of this year. She described socialism as the political system most compatible with democratic participation in our economic, social, and racial dignity. What the hell does that even mean? To me, she said, what socialism means is to guarantee a basic level of dignity. You see where I'm going with this? You see this mentality? Okay. It's asserting the value of saying that America, that the America we want and the America we are proud of is one of which in which all children can access a dignified education. It's one in which no person is too poor to have the medicines they need to live. It's to say that no individual's civil rights are to be violated. And it's to say that we need to really examine the historical inequities that we've created, or that have created, much of the inequalities, both in terms of economics and social and racial justice, because they're intertwined. Man, that's kind of a head-scratcher there, but okay. So when you look at what happened here, identity politics did play a big role in her congressional campaign. June 27th, 2018, New York Times. The report in New York Times stated that she was unafraid to foreground race, gender, age, and class. Her platform, as it was stated, was founded upon calls for a government-run universal health care system, which she dubbed Medicare for All. That's where that phrase came from, Medicare for All. A federal jobs guarantee, tuition-free public colleges, much stricter gun control limits or limits to the Second Amendment, criminal justice reform rooted in the notion that the existing justice system is awash in inequity against non-white minorities. Oh, and housing as a human right. And also, I mentioned Thomas Homan, the former director of ICE, the dissolution of ICE. And where have we heard the dissolution of ICE before? Oh, Kamala Harris. Kamala Harris equating ICE with the KKK, which is why Thomas Homan was on Sean Hannity last night to give his response, reply to that egregious accusation. Now, she's also, well, listen to this about Israel. When the Israeli military killed about 60 people on May 14th of this year, remember, there were thousands of rioters and protesters and people violently protesting the Donald Trump administration's decision to relocate the U.S. Embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Well, there were about 60 people who lost their lives in that melee. Ocasio-Cortez condemned Israel. Look at her tweets. Look at her Twitter timeline. She wrote, "This is a massacre. No state, no entity is absolved of mass shooting of protesters. There's just no justification. Palestinian people deserve basic human dignity as anyone else. Democrats can't be silent about this anymore." So who's supporting her? Among her most noteworthy supporters and endorsers, Bernie Sanders, Cynthia Nixon, Barack Hussein Obama, MoveOn.org, Our Revolution, the Democratic Socialists of America, oh, and oh yes, Black Lives Matter. All right, that's where you can see, okay, where her support comes from is where her allegiance will lie. Now, she was heavily outspent by Representative Joe Crowley. And despite being heavily outspent by Crowley, she won the Democratic congressional primary for the 14th district. That was back in June of this year. The community is ready for a movement of economic and social justice. There's that phrase again. This is what we tried to deliver. Now, when she showed up for a congressional Democratic luncheon, again, I'm digging deep into some details here, but details matter in this case. When she showed up for this Democratic luncheon, she was, according to a tweet that she posted, stopped because it was assumed that she was an intern or staffer. I don't know if you remember that, but she just didn't look the part there. And she wrote, "Next time, try believing women plus people of color when they talk about experiences being a woman or a person of color." Now she's playing both the gender card, the age issue, the race card. All right. And she, by the way, one of her heroes is Barbara Lee. Great respect and admiration for U.S. Congresswoman Barbara Lee. Okay, so that's who we have. That's who was elected. That's Ocasio-Cortez. Again, when you look at her knowledge or intellectual understanding of government, it's all socialism all of the time. Okay, now we see in the Midwest, we got an Islamic issue. We got a Muslim problem. And I say that understanding exactly what I'm saying. The people of Minnesota elected Ilhan Omar, I-L-H-A-N Omar. She is the youngest of seven children. Omar was born in Mogadishu, Somalia, back in 1982. And after civil war broke out there in 1991, she and her family fled to a refugee camp in Kenya. They spent 4 years there before coming to America. This woman later attended North Dakota State University, where she joined the Campus Muslim Students Association and eventually earned a degree in political science and international studies. Now, I just spoke about Ocasio-Cortez, the Neiman Marxist, the minority in air quotes, I suppose. Now, look at the Islamic component here. You've got the Marxist, true Marxist component. Now look at the Muslim component in the 2018 elections. These are the victors, by the way, the winners. And I haven't even talked about the losers yet. But look at this in the context of the path, the trajectory of where America is headed. And everyone should be concerned. But we can fight this on a number of levels. And one of those levels is to be armed with the accurate information about these people, about the people going into D.C. here in January, and about the people who will or expect to go into D.C. the next time around. But they still have influence over and within the U.S. culture. They're doing a lot of damage, a lot of damage. Because ask yourself this, kind of as a stopping side note here, ask yourself this, how is it possible that in the course of 10, 15, 20 years, America has gone full-blown socialist, or so it seems? Who's pulling the strings? How can this happen? The midterms, yes, we only, in quotation marks, lost at this moment 37 House seats. But how many were so close that we did win, but we're so close? What's propelling this? It's the socialist, it's this collectivist socialist lie that's being perpetuated upon the American people. And where this is coming from are some very dangerous people promoting this. And we have people like perhaps your brother-in-law or your uncle that are accepting this with open arms. I would say to them, do you know what you're accepting here? Because you will be on the chopping block as well. Just as much as I will, just as much as again, your brother-in-law, you, everyone. And let me just say this, at the risk of sounding like I'm bouncing back and forth, but this caravan invasion, this alien invasion, when you step back and you look and you understand the war that has been declared by the communists against the sanctity of our republic, against the moral fabric, against the cohesiveness of the United States, when you look at the war that's been declared against us, you cannot separate the alien invasion from the midterms. And you cannot separate these seemingly disparate events all across the United States without looking at first, some obviously you can kind of weed out, but look at the battle in its entirety. We are witnessing the attempted takedown, and I can't stress this enough, of the United States as a representative republic. We are the last beacon of freedom in the world, and that's at risk. And the only person right now that has a grasp, has a handle in power about the nature of the threat is a guy, 70-year-old guy, who is a successful businessman. Yeah, he had his bumps along the way, but he threw his hat in the ring because he knows what's at stake. So the only person, the only individual who really understands this better than most is this political outsider, Donald Trump, which is why he is so detested and so hated. When we finally, as a country, if this ever happens, when we finally understand the hatred or the genesis, the origin of the hatred of Donald Trump by the media, who he has declared the fake news media, the co-conspirators in the media who who propel fake news. When we understand that it's him, and we understand the reasons why, he's saying, look, those who propagate fake news in the corporate media, they're the enemy of the people. He's absolutely right, because they are the co-conspirators in this, if not the primary facilitators of the attempted takedown of the United States. But they've got to go through him to get to us at this point, which is another reason, seemingly like I'm going in different directions. But this is another reason why, when you look at these extrajudicial rulings or judicial rulings, for example, that this latest ruling this morning, this judge ruling about, hey, you got to let these people in, into the United States. No, we don't. But you see how for years the judiciary has been overtaken. It's been infiltrated by the communist Marxist thought, by the embracers of the communist philosophy and the Marxist philosophy, ultimately known as the collectivist philosophy. So our battlegrounds are in the judiciary. Our battlegrounds are in the governmental agencies, including ICE, and of course the optics behind the invasion coming into the United States. Notice, by the way, how Mexico has responded to this, or at least the mayor of Tijuana, saying, hey, wait a minute, we can't handle this. And Donald Trump was right. This is an invasion. Oh, and by the way, it was just discovered, I'm not sure you're going to hear this on the news, among the migrants there, I think among the 3,000 in Tijuana, there are 500 identified as criminals/felons from their home countries, the ones that they could vet. So anyway, so look at every event until proven otherwise. This is my suggestion. Look at every event until proven otherwise as a front, a battlefront on the war against our republic, against Donald Trump, and ultimately against you and me. All right, so you've got, again, these incoming members of Congress. You've got the Nieman Marxist. I don't get tired of saying that. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Now you've got, in the Midwest, you've got a couple of Muslims coming into Congress. Notably, Ilhan Omar, again, from Somalia. She worked in the, after getting her degree at the North Dakota State University. And remember, these are indoctrination centers. She joined the campus MSA, Muslim Students Association. Look that group up, Muslim Students Association. A very activist group, care-connected. Anyway, she worked as a community nutrition educator in Minneapolis, St. Paul for about 3 years. And then in 2012, she served as a campaign manager for one of the Democratic runners for Minnesota State Senate. Now, she is, I don't want to understate this or overstate this. She's a very harsh critic of Israel. It was on November 16th of 2012, it was right after Gaza, or right after Hamas, terrorist from Gaza, launched more than 150 rockets into Israel. Do you remember that? November 2012. And Israel responded. She tweeted that apartheid Israeli regime had hypnotized the world in order to conceal its own evil doings. Now consider the words there. So this newly elected congressman from Minnesota is already anti-Israel, already pro-Islamic Sharia, and anti-constitutional, because Sharia and the Constitution they just don't mix. But remember this too, all politics are local. Omar served as a senior policy aide to Minneapolis City Council member Andrew Johnson for 2 years, or 3 years actually, from 2013 to 2015. And while doing that, she acknowledged that she was a friend of several young men, guess what, who had joined a Somalian terrorist group aligned with Al-Qaeda. They were happy young men, she said. And then at some point something happened. And this is what needs to be researched and studied. What is happening to make them feel disconnected from a community that has birthed them? What happened to them? It's called Islam. But anyway, in 2016, she ran for the Minnesota House of Representatives on the Democratic Farmer Labor Party ticket. Soon after her victory in the primary that summer, she faced highly credible allegations that, in an effort to perpetuate immigration fraud and her student loan fraud, she married her own brother. That's right. She married her own brother. These are the allegations. In 2009, and was still legally his wife. And 7 years before that, back in 2002, Omar had married a first husband. His name is Ahmed Aden, the father of her three children. When Minnesota attorney Scott Johnson looked into the matter and asked Omar's campaign to clarify the facts, Minneapolis criminal defense attorney Gene Brandel responded on the candidate's behalf. And here's what Gene Brandel said. There are people who don't want an East African Muslim woman elected to the office who will not, or who will follow Donald Trump's playbook to prevent it. Let me repeat that. There are people who do not want an East African Muslim woman elected to office and who will follow Donald Trump's playbook to prevent it. In that one statement, she's deflecting from the question and calling Donald Trump a not just a racist, but a Islamophobe and a xenophobe. All right. Anyway, when Omar eventually petitioned to divorce back in 2017, she made a number of demonstrably false claims, including an assertion that she had not had any contact with her brother, by the way, since June of 2011. So yes, she married her brother in order to circumvent immigration law. This is who the people of Minnesota elected. She was elected to the Minnesota House in November of 2016. And listen to this, she got 81% of the vote. You ask why we've got this balkanization in this country? You've got, what base elected her? Was it really Minnesota white Anglo-Saxon Protestants? No. The community of Somalia, Little Mogadishu. Why do you think the left, the collectivists, the communists are pushing so hard for the caravan to invade the country and balkanize? Because they don't want the United States to exist in its current form. So that's Omar, by the way. And I could go on with Omar, take a bigger dive. But some of her, let me look at this here. Some of her positions in 2017, she was one of only two Minnesota House members out of 129 to vote against a bill to allow life insurance companies to deny payouts to beneficiaries of people who died while committing acts of terrorism. That's notable. I underlined that. Think about that. So if you're a terrorist, say you get $100,000 or $1 million life insurance policy, you go up and blow yourself up along with 10 other people. She's saying that the insurance company must pay out that benefit to the terrorist. Are you kidding me? In this year, she ran for the U.S. House, and that seat was formerly held, by the way, by Keith Ellison. Her campaign was supported by Our Revolution, that is Our Revolution, which is a group closely affiliated with Bernie Sanders. Oh, and the Council on American Islamic Relations supported her as well, linked to Hamas. They held three fundraising events on her behalf, shall I say, CARE did. Now, during a Democratic primary debate, which was held at a Minnesota synagogue, believe it or not, back in August of this year, she was asked to specify exactly where you stand on the boycott, divestment, and sanctions, the BDS movement, a Hamas initiative. In case you haven't heard it, I would think you have. She said, I believe right now I believe right now with the BDS movement, it's not helpful in getting that two-state solution. I think the particular purpose for BDS is to make sure that there is pressure, and the pressure is counteractive. Because in order for us to have a process of getting to a two-state solution, people have to be willing to come to the table and have a conversation about how that's going to be possible. And I think that stops the dialogue. In other words, she took the low road and is anti-Israel all the way. Well, this year, just 2 weeks ago, November 6th, she won her congressional race at 78%. She captured 78% of the vote. Think about that. To me, that's the headline. It's the Marxist-Muslim axis here. Need we be worried? Yes. And I apologize for taking so much time on these individuals, but when we look at the bigger picture here, because I've got pages upon pages. Look, we've got Rashida Tlaib from Minnesota, or I'm sorry, from Michigan. You've got Kyrsten Sinema that we need to discuss. You've got the groups, including but not limited to the Congressional Progressive Caucus, and also the Institute for Policy Studies. I haven't even touched on these. Of course, I've spoken before about the Congressional Progressive Caucus, but I haven't really touched upon the Institute for Policy Studies. In the next episode, I will do that. This perhaps is episode one, part one of two. I want to wrap this up noting the time that what we are looking at here is the push, the final push, the final phase towards tearing down the United States as we know it. Multiple battlefields. The invasion is one battlefield. The infiltration, another battlefield. We must, in addition to exposing this, we must fight this. Which leads me to my final point. The Hagman Report in my show and Joe Show, what we are doing, of course, is exposing this, but also as a group here, we are working on infiltrating, identifying, infiltrating, and fighting these groups. I'm going to have more on this later. I would urge everyone to help us out. I ask for your help because we need help to do this, to infiltrate, to expose, and to fight, to show America what this is all about, that this is a war for our lives. We are in the war of our lives right now. I hope that resonates with you. If you are a young parent with young children, look at your children and ask yourself, what kind of world are they going to grow up? What are they going to experience? Will it be the United States when it was mom and apple pie and patriotism and you know, the God in schools and prayer in schools? No. No. All of that has been torn down. We've tossed God out of schools back in the 60s. Of course, yesterday I spoke about the teacher, Pledge of Allegiance in Missouri, the teacher who was tossed out on his ear for thanking students who stood for the Pledge of Allegiance. This is what we have to fight. And we are going all out. Because this is our last, in my view, our last push against this cancerous rot that's infiltrating our country. So we must infiltrate the organizations, identify and expose the people and organizations, and also fight them legally, fight them in every way possible from taking over the United States of America. That's how important this is. Folks, I hope I made myself clear. I hope my message was kind of clear. I'd love your feedback. Please, feedback at Doug@HagmanReport.com. That's Doug@HagmanReport.com. If you like what you heard, tell people about this program and follow me. Best place to do that is on Blog Talk Radio, and follow me on Twitter @HagmanPI. HagmanPI. God bless.
The Doug Hagman Radio Show is brought to you by The Hagman Report. Tune in to the Hagman Report weekdays, 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. For more information, go to HagmanReport.com. That's HagmanReport.com.